I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to The Connection. We have become numb to the problem of workplace burnout. We've even normalized it as the price of success, the ticket to advancement, and a better job. But the symptoms of burnout can have serious, even deadly consequences. Debilitating headaches, stomach and sleep problems, chronic illnesses, including the risk for cardiovascular disease. Constant stress can lead to psychological problems as well. Emotional exhaustion, cynicism or negativity, and the feeling that you're not good enough at your job. Our guest, Candy Weens, should know. A visit to her doctor a dozen years ago revealed that her work ethic was killing her. Her blood pressure was sky high, and her doctor ordered bed rest. She used that time to reevaluate the quality of her life, which led her to become an authority on burnout. She's a senior fellow at the University of Pennsylvania, director of the Penn Master's Medical Education Program, and author of a new book, Burnout Immunity: How Emotional Intelligence Can Help You Build Resilience and Heal Your Relationship with Work. She joins us on The Connection to talk about what burnout taught her about how to find more balance in her life. And Candy Weens, nice to have you with us on The Connection.
Thank you, Marty. I'm happy to be here.
And happy to have you with us. And let's begin at the beginning. In fact, the beginning of your book, you talk about the fact that about a decade ago, you were at the doctor's office on your phone doing work. Mm-hmm. And the nurse there taking your blood pressure was just horrified at the numbers. What were those numbers?
Well, the numbers were shockingly high. But before I knew the numbers, I was pretty unaware of what I was experiencing. I was in the exam room where you go in for a routine annual exam and you think you're going to be in and out in 20 minutes and you get your A and you go back to work. I thought it was one of those annual visits. And in fact, I had scheduled work calls up to that doctor's appointment and immediately after. And I was working while I was in the waiting room and in the exam room. So the nurse, as they always do, they took my vital signs. She checked my blood pressure once, twice, a third, and then a fourth time. Didn't say anything at all. And that should have clued me in that something was going on. But it didn't. She left the room and I did what a lot of people would normally do, picked my phone back up and I kept working. I didn't even think about the fact that she just took my blood pressure four times and left the room. When she came back with the doctor and the doctor closed the door, held my hand and asked me, Candy, are you okay?
Wow.
That's when I knew something was really wrong. And they didn't tell me my blood pressure reading right away. It was actually not until they brought it back down until I knew that it was a shockingly high 200 over 110.
Wow.
Which is considered a hypertensive emergency. The doctor was asking me if I was okay, and I thought I was fine. I actually literally answered her that I feel fine, because that had become the new normal for me, having a very elevated blood pressure and feeling the stress that I was at the time. For like many people, it felt like the norm. I get up really early in the morning, and I do as much as I can with work, with the kids. I do it every day, all day, and I actually really loved my job. That's the scary thing, is that and as we'll talk today, burnout is one of those conditions, a psychological syndrome that is quite insidious. It really can sneak up on you.
And I'm curious why, and maybe with hindsight, you can look back on that time of your life, why you were disconnected, I guess mm-hmm. would be the word, from all those body sensations that were telling you, you know, Candy, this is stress. This is high stress.
Disconnection is a great way to put it. What happened to me anyway, and I see this quite frequently with people who are burned out, they become disconnected from the physical signs and symptoms of burnout, meaning that they're less aware and less connected to what those signs and symptoms are, because I was so focused on the work that I was doing and raising our three young children at the time. I was connected and focused on other things than my health, not just my physical health, but my psychological health. And that's one of the problems with burnout, is it really can sneak up on us with that, unless we're really paying attention. And that's what I found in my research, and we'll talk about, is that the whole book is about how to pay attention and really understand and gain an awareness of what your signs and symptoms are, not just physically, but what else is going on in your life that burnout can impact.
And we will get to all that. Let me ask you one or two more questions about mm-hmm. yourself, because you describe growing up in the West. You were the first in your family to go to college. Mm-hmm. Sounds like a difficult life with your mom. You went to move with your dad. and the kind of pressure, I guess, that you put on yourself to succeed, to be that person in the family who's going to do really, really well.
Yeah, I was what is now termed an insecure overachiever. I grew up with a food insecurity, housing insecurity, the insecurity of knowing whether my mom was going to come home at night or not. So there was a lot of insecurity in my life. And at the same time, I have the type of personality that I like to work. I'm achievement oriented, meaning that I like to set goals and work towards goals. And so those two things for me were a perfect combination of what eventually led to, I started out as like this hurry sickness. I was hurrying to reach all these goals, and then eventually it turned into something bigger and more dangerous, like burnout. But yeah, it was what happens with a lot of people is that these early ingrained conditions are with us for our lifetime. The way that we learn how to manage stress, the way that we're exposed to stressors when we're young, all of that follows us into young adulthood, into adulthood, and eventually into our careers, and can lead to some pretty unhealthy patterns and habits.
Well, and the doctor ordered essentially bed rest for you to go home and sort of stop doing all the things that you were doing. Mm-hmm. But how hard was it for you to change your life, to change your attitude, to change your relationship with your work and yourself?
Yeah. For me, it was hard work, but making the decision to make a change was actually easy because I had a life-threatening wake-up call. Many people who experience burnout don't have that kind of a wake-up call where it's almost life or death decision. It might be more the type of decision that is about, do I stay in this career, move to a different career? But for me, it was literally about, is my job making me so sick that I just can't do it anymore? And that's, so when I made the decision, laying on the couch for about 3 or 4 days during bed rest.
Which must have been hard for you, right?
Oh, it was hard. And I was also, they put me on Xanax for a couple of days just to really watch my blood pressure and make sure it was coming down, stabilize me. But it was during that time where I felt like finally someone's giving me permission to rest, to take a moment, take a breath, and really think about the sacrifices that I'm making in my personal life and in my health. And once I made that decision, what became an easy decision, the work ahead was hard, but it was worth it. I knew why I was working.
Well, it's interesting that you needed an emergency and an outside person to give you permission, to use your own words, to slow down.
Yeah.
De-stress.
Yeah. Yeah, to really take stock in my life and what was most important to me. And when we were talking earlier about what we're connected to or disconnected to, it really gave me an opportunity to see where my disconnections were in my life and where I needed to strengthen those connections with relationships, with my health, with really like this calling of the type of work that I really wanted to do, but I wasn't doing.
Interesting. I think we often use burnout and stress interchangeably, as if they're one and the same thing. But your book makes very clear that burnout is one thing, stress is something else. Let's define them both.
I'm glad we're talking about that because right now I feel like there's an overuse and sometimes a misuse of the word burnout. A lot of people will say, I feel really burned out. And they may, you know, that may be true for some people. Really what's happening though is many people are really just feeling a lot of stress, a lot of overextension, overworked, all of that. But that's not necessarily the same thing as burnout. So burnout, if you think about the difference between stress and burnout, stress could be a really bad headache for a very long period of time, or it could be like an acute headache that comes on but eventually goes away. Whereas burnout, as people who have been burned out, they describe it as a migraine.
Wow.
Something that is so intense and so excruciating and for a long period of time. And it feels for many people like it's a hopeless, helpless situation. So it is quite extreme. But stress obviously leads to burnout. That's why we study stress in addition to burnout.
Well, I would think sort of ongoing stress where you cannot control it. Mm-hmm. You know, you're sort of at the mercy of either someone else's dictates or your own, that's, mm-hmm. that can lead to just unremitting stress and then burnout.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really the chronic stress that, you know, I've interviewed a number of people who have experienced burnout and recovered from it. I've also interviewed people who are actively in burnout, and all of them have told me, literally 100% of them have told me, it wasn't because of something bad that happened yesterday or today. It wasn't like having even a series of a couple of bad days in a row. It's really more that chronic, unrelenting, long-term stress that is quite intense and doesn't go away. And you mentioned control, the sense that they don't have control over it.
Right. I wonder, you sort of referenced this earlier, even about yourself, as you said, you were kind of a hard-driving, probably still are a hard-driving mm-hmm. person, whether it was you that created the burnout or was it something about your job? As you said, you loved your job. Yeah. I mean, can you love your job and get burned out?
You can love your job and get burned out, yes. So let me break that down a little bit. And in the book, I write about it's not you, it's your job.
Big
capital letters. I want to stand on a soapbox right now and let everybody know that if you are feeling burned out and you are really recognizing just how painful it is and what it's doing to you in your life, I want to give everybody a bit of hope that it is not you, it is your job. But really, what it even more specifically, it's your response to your job. Okay, so your job itself might be creating the conditions for you to burn out, but what you do have control over, what we all have control over, is how we respond to those conditions. So that's how we can break ourselves free from burnout, is recognizing that the conditions that we're experiencing at work, if they're not good for us or perhaps even toxic, we need to find a way to get out of them. Whether that's, and I don't mean just leaving your job, I mean, looking really closely at what the stressors are and looking at what you can control and not, and a number of strategies in the book for how to break that down.
Indeed. About a minute before our first break here, I mean, it seems like there's sort of a mismatch between, mm-hmm. you know, yourself and your relationship with your work or maybe with your boss or your coworkers.
Right.
Something is off.
There is something off, yeah. I really geeked out on this when I got into the research. I really was really interested in, like, are there certain personality types or people with certain temperament? Are they better fit for certain jobs? And we know this, like, that's pretty common sense. And, of course, research bears it out. But you will find that if you tune into what your personality is and your temperament, the type of work conditions you like, the type of work conditions and environment where you thrive in, that's going to be very different than, you know, some other work conditions where you just don't feel like you fit. And that misalignment will gradually grind you down and wear you down and can lead to burnout.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with Candy Weens. She's got a new book. It's called Burnout Immunity, and it's subtitled How Emotional Intelligence Can Help You Build Resilience and Heal Your Relationship with Work. We began by her talking about her own experience with burnout and how that has led her to be a burnout researcher. She's senior fellow at the University of Pennsylvania and director of the Penn Masters in Medical Education Program. We've got much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back, and you're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Candy Weens, and she's telling us how emotional intelligence can help heal your relationship with your job. And her new book is titled Burnout Immunity. You wrote a piece recently in the Harvard Business Review, I think it was, about 40% of Gen Z workers believe that burnout comes with the job, which I thought was pretty shocking to feel like, all right, I'm going to have this job and I can expect to burn out.
It is shocking, and it's true.
And
it's not just Gen Z, actually. So that I reported on that, and I that was the angle of that article for sure. But we have one of my doctoral students, actually, she conducted a study of high-level executives who reported pretty much the same thing, that they believed that in order for them to be successful at a certain point in their career, burnout was an inevitable part of that success. Wow. It was an inevitable expectation, in fact, from their leaders that they would burn out and that they would be, to some degree, observed and watched to see how they would bounce back from that or what they would do once if they got burned out. So it's pretty rampant, not just with Gen Z, but across the board, this belief that we need to burn ourselves out in order to be successful.
And yet you also say that burnout affects productivity. Mm-hmm. I mean, it affects so many aspects of the workplace. You know, to think that it's inevitable or that it's even encouraged is going to have some kind of blowback.
Yeah, it backfires. And that's really sad. I work with a lot of organizational leaders and chief HR executives who are really trying to find that fine balance between how to really bring out the best in their people. And by best, I mean like best productivity and quality of their work, but also not burning them out, because it really is a fine line. We need some degree of stress. Everybody needs some stress in order to perform really well and learn and grow. But if they get too much, all of us, if we get too much stress for too long a period of time, that can easily tip us over into burnout zone.
Well, in fact, you talk about the sort of sweet spot of success, the kind of Goldilocks of success, not too much, not too little. What does that look like? What does that feel like?
Yeah, the sweet spot of stress is one of my favorite concepts in the book. And I spend a lot of time thinking about this myself, because I'm still actively working to both recover from burnout as well as like prevent myself from burning out again. So the sweet spot of stress, if you think about this, the fact that we all need a little bit of stress to feel challenged and motivated and want to perform better, and it puts us in this what we call growth and learning zone, that's good. But if we get too much stress, again, for a long period of time, or that's the wrong kind of stress, for example, the stress is due to a toxic work environment, or you work with a leader or a boss who you just don't have a good relationship with. So if the stress itself becomes more and more difficult to manage, it's likely for people to tip over into feeling anxious, starts to affect their productivity, their health, and eventually that if that continues for a long period of time, that can lead to burnout.
I mean, it sounds like learned helplessness, where you feel like, talk about control, that there are things that you do not have control over.
Yeah. And the whole point about when people feel like they have control, that mindset and that understanding of what you really have control over can lessen the effects of burnout. But people who over-focus on the things that they can't control, spend too much time worrying about all the things we can't control, that is a condition that could set us up for burnout.
We've been focusing largely on, you know, executives and sort of high-powered jobs, but I'm also thinking of people working in low-income jobs, mm-hmm. probably several of them, in order to support a family.
Yep.
And the kind of, you know, ongoing, every day, every moment kind of stress that they're under, and mm-hmm. and the kind of burnout that must become a way of life in a way.
Yeah. So in my studies, I have studied a number of leaders, a lot of chief medical officers, about 30 police chiefs and deputy and assistant chiefs all over the country. But I've also studied a lot of bartenders and baristas and teachers and lawyers and frontline workers. A lot of my interviews tend to be informal. It might be just a 15 or 20 minute conversation, and I'll do some observation of that person under stress,
wow.
really watching to see how they're dealing with maybe an acute stress situation. And one of the things I find with frontline workers and people who are making minimum wage and experiencing also most likely a lot of stress outside of their job is that they are really good. The ones who are not burned out, I should say, are really good at compartmentalizing. Hmm. And they're able to leave their work stress at work, and they take full advantage of their time out of work to focus on the things and the people that matter to them and bring them joy. Those are the ones who tend to have greater strength in preventing themselves from getting burned out. Whereas the ones who bring work home, you know, and worry about all the things and the boss who's difficult and the coworkers and those people tend to be more prone to burnout.
Because you just can't turn it off,
it
right?
Can't turn
your
it off.
Your mind is always going.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's part of emotional intelligence. Emotional intelligence is being aware that we're triggered by stress, that something in the work environment is triggering us, is making us feel anxious, frustrated, angry, all the feelings that come with stress. But then the harder thing is emotional regulation.
Yeah.
Really being aware of that emotion, recognizing that it's not good for us, and then finding ways to regulate our emotions. And I offer a number of strategies. Just one example of a strategy is managing our emotional investment in work. So the frontline workers I talked about, they are the ones who avoid burnout, are good at managing their emotional investment in work. Again, they're not taking it home at the end of the day.
Well, it's interesting because your book is both about connections and boundaries, sort of knowing the difference of when you need a boundary and when you need connections.
Yes, and both are extremely important. And sometimes we need both. We need to set boundaries so that we have time, energy, mental, physical capacity to connect to the things, connect to people that bring us joy in our lives. But boundaries, if they're not just set or they're not enforced, right, that eats into our time and our energy to be able to connect to those things we love.
Let's go a little deeper into sort of how our body then responds to sort of unmitigating ongoing stress. What is happening inside? I mean, this is something you were experiencing, this enormously high blood pressure, but take us inside the body. What's going on in there?
So it's really interesting process. What happens is when we are stressed, whether it's an acute stress, acute meaning something happens in a split second, just like that, and we go from, say, a 3 level of stress to a 10 level of stress, or if it's chronic stress for a long period of time, either one of those things, what's happening in our brain is that something called the amygdala is triggered. Our amygdala is our fight, flight, or freeze response, and that is meant to protect us. That's actually a really healthy function that we have, this amygdala that can protect us from real threats in life. But most of us aren't being chased by...
No, thank goodness.
Right, by grizzly bears or anything like that. So when our amygdala is triggered and going off frequently, or it's going off and staying off, meaning that it is pumping cortisol into our body for a long period of time, that can then trigger all kinds of other bad stress hormones that deplete our energy. It actually constricts our blood vessels. So that's why people with high blood pressure have that issue, is because their vessels are actually constricted when they're under stress. And if that happens for a long period of time, that's what can put them into emergency situations.
I mean, that is stress as a threat. I mean,
exactly.
that's how our body is perceiving it. It's interesting to see how that then affects our emotional well-being. And you talk about the kind of cynicism and negativity that can happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a sense that, I'm not good at my job.
Yeah.
That it infects that part of our psyche.
Mm-hmm. Cynicism is an interesting one. It can infect our psyche. It can also infect the work culture around us. So if we become cynical, and we are working in close proximity to other people who are cynical, it's just going to spread and it's going to accelerate. And before you know it, you have a full-blown cynical group of people working together, which is not healthy.
Not very much fun, right?
No, not fun and not healthy at all. But yeah, so certainly we talked about emotional exhaustion being a big part of how people feel when they're burned out. But another clear sign that someone is feeling burned out is that they feel less optimistic, just much more negative, pessimistic, cynical about people that they work with. That's a clear sign that you might be heading into burnout.
You also say, you know, pay attention to the words, to the language that you use, or maybe that your colleagues are using, because they can be a giveaway. And these are sort of obvious, but I can't do this anymore. I'm fed up. I'm hopeless. I'm helpless. I mean, these are all signs that you're either in burnout or headed towards burnout.
That's right. Yeah, that feeling like if you hear yourself saying, I can't do this anymore, or I'm fed up, listen to that voice. That is your psyche telling you to stop and take a really close look. Have a conversation with someone you love and trust about what you're experiencing.
You also talk about slow thinking, fast thinking. I mean, how that, you know, when we're kind of revved up, it's we're in that fast thinking mode, which is not particularly thoughtful.
No. And it actually gets us, it actually causes more stress. Yeah. So when we're stressed, and I mentioned when our amygdala goes off and we start to exert all these bad chemicals in our body, constricting our blood vessels, that can cause us to jump into fast thinking where we're not thinking logically. We're just it's that feeling of you can't find your car keys in the morning, and so you're scrambling all over the house trying to find your car keys. And the more you scramble, the more stressed you get. When really, if you were to just slow down, pause for about 10 seconds and think about the last place that you saw your keys, that's usually when we find our keys. But that's the difference between stress causing us to get into fast thinking. But we need to deliberately pause and take a look at our emotions, take a deep breath. That's why breathing exercises can work very effectively, but really slow our thinking down, slow our breathing down. That slows our heart rate down so that we can think more clearly and more strategically about what we actually want to do with the stressor.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Candy Weens, and we're talking about her new book. It's called Burnout Immunity, and it's subtitled How Emotional Intelligence Can Help You Build Resilience and Heal Your Relationship with Work. And she's a senior fellow at the University of Pennsylvania, where she's director of the Penn Masters in Medical Education program. You say also that stress and, I guess, burnout can kind of sneak up on you, where you feel like you're, and maybe that sort of tells your story as well, is that all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, but over time, you realize, oh my God, I'm like, you know, I'm in panic mode because something's wrong.
Yeah, it's a lack of awareness, you know. And I see people who are very gritty. We talk a lot about grit, right? People who persevere through challenges, type A personalities, very achievement and goal-oriented people can be susceptible to burnout, like if they love their jobs even too, right? They get over-engaged in their work. They throw themselves into work so much that they lose awareness of what's going on. And that lack of awareness sneaks up. The good thing, though, is that when we become more aware, that's the first step, and then caring. So we want to get to a point where we are both aware of what stress is doing to us and then care enough for and about ourselves to do something different.
In fact, you say awareness was really one of the paths that led you out of your burnout crisis.
Yeah. Yeah, when I spent those 3-4 days on the couch and was in some reflection mode at that point, I noticed that I was really becoming more and more attuned to just my feelings, my emotions, how I felt physically, and how the stress was impacting me psychologically, how it was impacting relationships. But that awareness is really the big and the first most important step any of us can work on to protect ourselves from burnout.
And that's where the slowing down comes from, where, I mean, if you're always revved up, there's no time to think about things like that.
That's right, yeah. Slowing down allows us to take a look at what's going on in my work conditions. It's not just like that one bad day I had, but what are the patterns that I see? What are the things that are really causing this mismatch between what I want and need in a job and what my work environment is actually giving me? So when we're able to stop and take a closer look really at what's making us more vulnerable to burnout, then we can approach each of those things a little more thoughtfully and strategically.
But why is burnout so common, so such a big problem? And I say that because you say the root cause is the workplace. So what is it about the workplace, the way we've designed work, maybe beyond even this country, that makes it so difficult to do?
Yeah. I'll comment on a couple. I could probably spend a whole hour on this, but let me just give you two specific big examples that I think are pretty common. Number one, if you look at professions that we call the caring professions or giving professions, social work, education, clinical work, so physicians and nurses, and really anyone who is working with other people to provide a service or to help educate them or treat them, those individuals are exposed to a lot of other people's emotions all day, in addition to the work demands themselves. Like, forget about the fact that these folks in those jobs might be underpaid or likely underpaid for doing massive amounts of really important work.
Right.
But then when they are spending almost all day with people, patients and family members, children, whose emotions are kind of all over the board, that's emotionally taxing. And so that can lead to emotional exhaustion, one of the key symptoms of burnout. fairly quickly. So that's why we see high rates of burnout in certain professions.
And people leave those professions, right?
They do. That's right. Yeah. And the other thing that we see, and this kind of goes hand in hand with some of these professions, is that one of the other major contributors to burnout is the culture in the environment that they're working in, specifically things related to fairness and equity, as well as compensation and just overall rewards and recognition for the work itself. Also things like support. So if someone has a very demanding job that they are capable of, let's say they're trained to do it, they are confident in their abilities in that job. But if they have too much work to do with not enough support, that can also lead to burnout as well.
You write about people called servant leaders, and I don't often put those two words together, but that there are, in terms of sort of mitigating this problem of burnout, that servant leaders, leaders who I guess are in service to the people that work for them, that can go a long way to mitigating this problem.
It can, yeah. I dedicate a whole chapter to 4 specific types of mindsets that people have that can protect them from burnout, and having a servant leader mindset is one of those. And I this came up, actually, it was quite a surprise in my research. I wasn't expecting to hear about this. So I dug into it with a number of physicians and nurses that I interviewed, as well as a number of law enforcement leaders. And what I heard, what they would tell me is, you know, Candy, I've known since I was 5 years old that I wanted to be a police officer.
Oh, wow.
I've known since I was 7 years old that I wanted to be a teacher. And so I've known that that's my calling and that I want to serve my community. I want to serve children. This mindset of I am here, part of my purpose in my life is to give to other people. And so you would think, and it, for some people that can cause burnout if that's not what they want, right? If they're in those type of professions, like I just mentioned, it could be a high risk burnout situation. However, servant leader mindset can protect you if you know you're going into that profession, you know that's what you're going to get, you know you're going to make personal sacrifices. And so they have other strategies to protect themselves from burnout.
Such as?
Such as like being really clear that they need lots of recovery time. Lots of time at work, micro recovery. Heard lots of stories about throughout the workday, micro recovery, taking, you know, even a 4-minute break, whatever it may be. As well as like being really intentional about their recovery on their days off and on their vacations, knowing that they need not just physical recovery, especially if their job is physically demanding, but these professions are psychologically demanding. So they need to give their psyches a break. So doing things they love to do outside of work with people they love to be around.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Candy Weens is our guest today on The Connection, and we're talking about her brand new book. It's called Burnout Immunity, and again, subtitled How Emotional Intelligence Can Help You Build Resilience and Heal Your Relationship with Work. We've got much more to talk about after this very short break, including another question about servant leaders. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. About a dozen years ago, our guest, Candy Weens, nearly died from too much stress juggling her job, her family, while working on her PhD. It became a wake-up call, and we're talking about her new book that just came out, and it's called Burnout Immunity. And she is a burnout researcher and also a senior fellow at the University of Pennsylvania. Let me just pick up on something else, and just this whole servant leadership. I mean, your definition here is the servant leader is focused on other people. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's sort of simple, but not.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that mindset that other people and their needs are so important to me that I'm willing to make some personal sacrifices In other words, one of the things that happens with servant leaders when they're working with people, children or patients or even frontline workers who believe that they're in that job because they like helping other people and serving other people, what's happening is their perception of a stressor is different than someone who doesn't have who's more focused on themselves. So let's say, for example, that you have a servant leader mindset and you know you've been called to do the kind of work that you do, whereas I don't, same type of job, but we experience this exact same stressors. I'm going to perceive a particular stressor a lot differently than you.
Yeah.
So it starts with how we perceive the stressor before we start feeling it.
You also write about the importance of values and maybe, again, you know, looking at mismatches, but just and values having to do with meaning and purpose in life. I mean, mm-hmm. This is who I am. This is how I behave. This is how others see me. How important that is to our identity and its impact on our ability to sort of withstand some of the stresses of the job.
Yeah. And values can also be a contributor, I should say, a misalignment between your values and your job's values can be a major contributor to burnout. For many people, values are a reflection of really who they are to the core, what's really most important to them. And so if you find yourself working in an organization or in a job where you feel like your company and other people around you value things that you don't, that's going to cause stress. That's just human nature that we're going to be stressed anytime we're in an environment where our values are out of whack with the people right. around us. And so the longer that stress sticks around, it's going to grind us down and burn us out.
You know, it's 4 years since the start of the pandemic. It's sort of hard to believe that so much has happened and that was 4 years ago. But nonetheless, that has really changed the nature of work in so many ways, including and most obviously working remotely. Mm-hmm. And we talked about connections and boundaries and disconnections. How do you see remote work and its impact on burnout?
Yeah, this was really interesting. I think a lot of people can relate to many of us were sent home immediately on March 13th or whatever it was. And we were working from home for long periods of time. University of Pennsylvania, many of us still work from home because of just the nature of our jobs changing. For extroverts, people who like to be around other people and like to work and engage in a physical environment with their colleagues, that was painful.
Yeah.
Going to work at home in an office by yourself.
It was lonely.
Exactly. And loneliness is also a big contributor to burnout. Mm-hmm. But the introverts, you know, they were having a great time. They were, and many still are if they're able to continue working from home. That's an environment where many introverts tend to thrive. So that's a great example of our personality. A personality being something that we can't necessarily change. It's an innate part of us. If our personality is really mismatched with our current job conditions, that's going to create stress.
So is it a matter of sort of tailoring the job then mm-hmm. to people's personalities as a way to prevent burnout?
It can be,
and
yeah.
And can that be done fairly and squarely?
That's a challenge for organizations. It has been the last several years. And at Penn, a number of us have been studying it. A number of my colleagues, I should say, have been studying what is working in organizations, you know, with this, whether it's stay completely remote, bring everybody back to the office, or some combination of hybrid, a little bit of both. And it varies per organization and what their needs are. But we do see that a lot of companies are taking their employees' interests and their what they want into consideration more than they used to.
So if you give employees, I mean, this may seem like a dumb question, but if you give employees what they want, chances are you'll reduce burnout?
Well, give them choice.
Give them choice.
Give them choice and agency in the decision. Even if ultimately the decision is, no, I'm sorry, everybody, but we need everybody on site in the office 2 days a week or whatever, on campus, whatever. If employees are at least given the opportunity to voice their input and then they're told the reason why when the decision is made, that at least helps people understand, like, okay, at least I was asked and they're listening.
We did a show a while ago on emotional intelligence, and emotional intelligence is part of the subtitle of your book. How mm-hmm. how do you define that?
Yeah. Emotional intelligence, most researchers agree on this, is that it's made up of really two big components. The first big component is all about myself, my my self-awareness, an awareness of my values, my strengths, my weaknesses.
Knowing yourself.
Knowing yourself, all of that. And then with that is then also being able to regulate and manage myself, regulate and manage my emotions, thoughts, and behaviors. And there are other things, but those are the three. Manage my emotions, thoughts, behaviors. The second big component of emotional intelligence is sometimes called social intelligence. That's our ability to both understand and be aware of what's going on in our environment socially, as well as being able to manage my relationships with other people in that environment or in that context.
And this can be taught, can be learned?
Absolutely. We teach it all the time. Yeah. I've been teaching emotional intelligence now for, 10 years. And it truly is something that can be taught. And it takes work and effort. It's not just something someone can go to a seminar or even take a semester-long course. You have to do the work in terms of really focusing on self-reflection, self-management. But absolutely, it can be done.
I mean, is it a form of self-therapy in a way? Because you're looking at sort of, who am I and what are my impulses and how do I behave with people?
Exactly. What are my impulses? What are my triggers? This is an interesting one. So I write about triggers. You know, what might trigger me might not trigger you. And what might trigger me today might not have triggered me even 2 weeks ago. What I'm getting triggered by now is because I've got many other stressors on my plate. And so my tolerance level is really down. And so our triggers, the more we understand about what triggers us, why and when we get triggered, the better we're able to control our reaction when we get triggered.
Another part of your subtitle is our relationship with work. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was an interesting juxtaposition of several words, not our relationship at work, but with work. Mm-hmm. And I guess work, in many ways, defines who we are. We spend an inordinate amount of time, on the job if we're employed somewhere.
Yeah. I thought about this. This what really hit home with me personally, this whole concept that I have a relationship with my work. It's not just that I go to work and I get paid in exchange for my services and that, but work is an important aspect of my life and I want to have a healthy relationship with it. And I'll never forget something that I was asked in an interview one time. It was actually my boss at Penn, Dr. Annie McKee. The one and only interview question she asked me was, how do you want this job to fit into your life?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, she already knew my qualifications. We worked together.
Right.
But she wanted to know, how do you see this job fitting into your life? And to me, that was just such a powerful question that I think about now all the time, really, is how my life is so much more. My identity is so much more than just my job. My job is very important to me, but it's just one aspect of my life. So what kind of relationship do I want to have with this job? I want it to be healthy. What does that mean? What does that look like?
I mean, that's the part of the sort of inventory of of emotional intelligence, which is just asking those challenging questions in a lot of ways.
Yeah, asking those questions, like doing some soul searching. And what does that look like for me when I say I want flexibility or that I want work-life balance. What exactly does that look like?
Yeah. Resilience is also plays a big role in this book as well. Mm-hmm. And, I think of resilience, and broadly speaking, as the ability to recover from a difficult situation. Is there a certain way you see resilience?
Yeah. Resilience is defined many different ways by different people, but the most common definition I hear, and I think that most people go by, is that it's our ability to bounce back from really bad stressors or stress that sticks around for a long period of time. And as we age, as we become more mature and wiser, have more experiences with certain type of stressors, we become naturally more resilient because our psyche is, when we're triggered by a stressor, our psyche might subconsciously say to ourselves, oh, I've seen this before. I've seen something like this before. I've gotten myself through something similar before. So it gives us a bit of self-confidence to be able to then approach the stressors in the future.
What's the role then of optimism? I mean, I sort of hear it, but expand on that.
Yeah, optimism. So Dr. Karen Rivich at Penn actually does a ton of research on the role of optimism in resilience. Her work is fascinating. And it came up in mine as well that people who have not just an optimistic view of things, but a really positive outlook. Hmm. So not just an optimistic, I guess, attitude about something today, but it's really an outlook into the future that's positive oriented, my subjective experience of a stressor will be much different than if I have a negative outlook towards the future. I just naturally will think, okay, this is challenging and difficult right now. And I actually believe that while I work my way through this, I'm going to end up learning something, contributing something. Wow. Is ultimately going to be good for me and other people.
If that does not come naturally, you know, that's your natural catastrophizer. Mm-hmm. How do you change that language or that conversation in your head?
Yep. So learning how to be optimistic is work too. That's also emotional intelligence sort of work, where we can reflect on, well, where is that less than optimistic attitude or perspective coming from? Like, what's underneath that? Mm-hmm. Is it something in my childhood? Was it some experience I had in my first job? You know, maybe my current boss today reminds me of a camp counselor I had who was really rude to me. And so that's triggering me. And so I tend to approach certain situations more pessimistically, like more timidly. But through self-reflection and self-awareness, we can learn how to view that stressor a little differently. That, like, instead of letting something trigger us, we can ask ourselves questions around, well, what can I learn about myself as I work with this person that I think is going to be difficult to work with, but having a more positive orientation towards that stressor.
Something you said sort of triggered something in my mind, whether at work we sort of recreate pieces of our family of origin or our childhood, or as you say, people that remind us of other people. Mm-hmm. And then we react maybe unconsciously in response to them.
Yeah, it happens all the time. And that's really hard to put our finger on.
Yeah.
Right? That colleague that we're working with, we can't quite figure out, like, we know that person really irritates us or gets under our skin. But when we are able, whether through therapy or coaching or even just personal self-reflection, it is possible to eventually understand, like, what's underneath that? Where did that come from? Is that part of my personality, something I was born with? I just have, you know, a certain personality that does not work, like oil and water with this other type of person? Or is it some learned behavior? I've learned that when I work with people like this,
this is how I behave. Right?
This is how I behave because it reminds me of my older brother.
In our past life. How important is it to have a buddy at work? I mean, someone that you can maybe gossip with or, you know, share hopes and fears with.
Yeah, that's actually a finding from my very good friend, Dr. Annie McKean. She was my boss at Penn for a number of years. Her latest research has looked at, like, what do we need to be happy at work? And it turns out that having a buddy, a friend, even a best friend at work is critically important, especially to people who really value relationships. Right. And that seems common sense. But if you think about your friends at work and how you engage with them, oftentimes it's to commiserate, right? It's to let
but
off a little
steam.
Yeah,
you?
That is a healthy part of dealing with stress. Right. Is being able to blow off that steam in a safe, healthy way without then cycling on that, you know, and turning it into a negative situation.
I'm looking at the clock here. I'm also looking at the very end of your book. I always read people's acknowledgments. And you had mentioned your dad earlier, and you say, my dad, Robert Weens, is the most resilient role model I ever met. His role modeling was perhaps the single biggest reason for my interest in resilience literature. His life experiences would have resulted in dire consequences for most people, but his mental strength and emotional stability saved his life and probably mine, too.
Yeah, that's very true. I will get choked up talking about my dad.
I got choked up reading that, but yeah, go ahead.
Oh, my dad's an amazing person. He experienced a tragedy and a trauma that no parent should ever experience when I was 5 years old. And without sharing the details of that, it was one of those life experiences that most parents, it would have ruined their life and many other people's lives around them. But my dad was a very strong person and very clear that he wanted me and my other younger sister to have a good upbringing. He wanted us to go to school and he wanted us to go to college. And so he was very focused on that, and that having his attention focused on us took his mind off of other things that could have led to stress really breaking him down.
Well, it sort of picks up, we're almost on a timer, but it picks up on what you were saying earlier about these servant leaders that focus on other people. I mean, yeah. In a way, sounds like he was one of those servant leaders.
He was, and he still is very much a servant leader, yeah. And sometimes I think of it as a reminder to myself and others that I work with when I'm coaching them is every once in a while we just need to get out of our own heads. And it's not, I don't mean that as in blame ourselves for the stress and the burnout we're feeling, but it's also like every once in a while, get out of our own heads. And believe it or not, when we help other people, that's a different kind of a stress response. So if I'm like really stressed, the last thing I want to do sometimes is get on a call and coach somebody or talk to a friend of mine. But inevitably, it turns out that when I do, that makes me feel better. So we need to sometimes get out of our own heads and find ways to help other people and connect with other people.
Well, a great way to end our conversation, Candy Weeks. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
It's a great conversation. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And again, the book is titled Burnout Immunity, How Emotional Intelligence Can Help You Build Resilience and Heal Your Relationship with Work. And thank you for joining us on The Connection, which airs every Friday and Sunday at noon right here on WHYY. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Instagram and find us on Facebook. Check out our website, whyy.org/theconnection. Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler produced the show. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Again, thanks for joining us.